The Ballad of Heartwork is a new series from The Heart is a Dungeon. Most of the story will be whimsical in nature, with moments of fear or sadness. Please take care of yourself and check the content warnings for each episode. And thank you so much for listening.
We see the end of the story. Not our story, but the story nonetheless. We see a world empty of all sentient life and the ruin of the largest city that anyone has ever dreamed. There is a long unkept promise, there is a name yet to be read aloud, and there is you. Not a god, not a mortal, but more of an idea. More of a season than an angel, and more like a star than a monster. You are either all that is left, or you are the beginning of something new. When we turn to your page and begin to read, where do we find you in this broken world? And what do we see when we close our eyes and see you?
You begin to see Hugh. Hugh is a solid gray being who takes the form of a corporate man. He's in an all gray suit, black dress shirt, gray tie, silver skin, silver short cut hair. And he is sitting in the remains of an abandoned, rotting, rusted car. In the driver's seat, holding a clipboard up against his chest. The clipboard doesn't have anything official written on it. It doesn't have paper. It just looks to be kind of this like black abyss situation. And he's holding a pencil made of light that he can make notes on the abyss with. And he's got his knees kind of curled up into his chest while he's holding the clipboard, is reviewing everything, pretending he's parked outside of where he needs to be. And he's just making notes to himself like, okay, okay, okay. Today is green. This will likely be my long day. A lot of things are green. It's the most commonly occurring color in nature. Put my head out of the window of the car, and I'm like staring up into like what would be the sun or the light source of the planet, kind of holding my pencil up against it, moving it back and forth. Wavelengths are correct still. Some things never change. and he opens the door of the car. The door falls off onto the ground, looks down on it, and goes, "Metal can be green." Proceeds along a stone pathway leading into a large wood. Some of the wood maybe isn't the correct color as of yet, but that's why he has the pencil.
And Hugh, the world is open to you, as much as anything lost to time can be. The door falls to the ground. The sound is strange and unnatural in this space. Birds take to the air, begging you to make a wish, as the gentle fox spread news through the underground of your movements as they watch you go about your calling.
It's a process. Making sure the colors are correct has to abide by the laws of nature. Wavelengths have to reach the right places. Pigments have to be lined up with the right molecules. I have eyes that can see everything that needs to be seen. Color is the thing that dictates how the world functions. So in a way, I have the most important job when rebuilding a world or creating one from scratch, because if you get the colors wrong, you can mess everything up. So when the birds fly out, I'm seeing it in kind of a slow motion way, the way that a fly would. You can see my eyes, though I've kind of trained them to reflect whatever dominant sentient life form will be on any given planet. They function differently. I can see everything. I can see the wavelengths. I can see the pigments. I can see the molecules. So when the birds fly out, I am comparing the bird to the trees they're flying out of. And if I catch one that's incorrect, it's as simple as holding out my hand, drawing it to me, looking over the wings, checking the ridges, the core of the bird, making sure its markings are correct, and then releasing it again. And then copy-pasting, if you will, across birds of a similar species. Something that may be rebellious, if you will, is if I catch an absence of color. So if I'm looking through this forest, I note that grass tends to be the biggest culprit of color shift, because a grass can go from green to yellow to brown, etc. That's the correct way to do it. But sometimes when you leave a planet alone for long enough, the yellow comes too early. You should not be yellow. You are green, and I wave the pencil over it, and the natural pigments of that grass returns to it, matching the rest of the field. You know, that's pretty typical for abandoned worlds, random yellow patches, so we'll keep an eye out for those.
When you encounter a shade or tone that is resisting the order of light, which has traveled across the galaxy to here and now, do you see it as though they need correction, or that they can be called into their proper destiny?
Hugh isn't much of a destiny person. Destiny is something that the sentience made up to try and make sense of a world that already makes sense, that has patterns, that has rules, that has laws. So it's more of a correction. Laws are meant to be followed. Color is no different. Color is unchanging. So it's a correction for sure. And yeah, sometimes you see animals evolve in a way to reflect colors they wouldn't normally reflect, but evolution is a law in and of itself, and he allows that sort of thing to happen. So he's just going through the forest, adjusting things in the trees, making notes, kind of, you know, smiling a little bit to himself, being like, all right, it's going to be busy, but it's been pretty easy so far here today. Everything seems to be in order. It's a lot easier when you don't have people to muck around with things, I suppose. I take pride in my work. I take pride in accuracy, because if I fail and I'm not good at my job, the world simply will not function. If I add things that ought not to be here, it can cause a ripple effect that impacts everything. I've worked with people in the past who have whimsy in their heart or try to sway me one way or the other, saying, wouldn't it be lovely if this thing was this color? To do so, I would have to change the light source. I'd have to bend the wavelengths. And if we bend the wavelengths, that's going to make the dwellers have to look at the world differently. We'd have to rebuild them. We'd have to rebuild everything from scratch if the light source is different and wrong. Inventing color requires a changing of everything, and then we start over, and then where are we? We have nowhere to live because our ideas are bigger than what can exist. So it is my job. I take pride in that. I take pride in never having failed on a job, and that the laws of color continue on uninterrupted. And that is, in no small part, thanks to me. Hugh takes lunch. Hugh takes a lunch break, kind of sitting up against a boulder, kind of doodling to himself on the abyss of a clipboard he has, and he's just watching all the animals move and interact, occasionally pointing at one, saying, tone down the red, not on the agenda, but if I see it, I can catch it, that fox drifting a little bit towards an orange he should not be. We'll tone that down a little bit. You don't need to worry about those predators. You have different ones. And he's sitting there thinking to himself, the thing I create today is order. Color and order is what I make. And I'm happy with that. Look. And like he draws in a rabbit into his hand and he's looking it over. And he says, like, this rabbit is a dark, dark blue. Should be black. Just kind of like sucks some of the color out of the rabbit and places it back down. And in his own mind, he's thinking, see, this rabbit's happier being the correct color. There's no reason for it to be blue. It shouldn't be reflecting that color. This is what gets me excited. I'm watching the world fall into the positions it should be in. When things are correct, things are happy, things function, and things continue. This will get broken eventually, but it's important to remember that the difficulty and the hardness and the many, many generations it takes to make things complete and in order is always worth the risk of chaos. I would like to do a shape roll. That's an 8 on the die. My shape modifier is a 3, so I've rolled an 11. I can change small things all across the world forever. And as I'm pondering order and the risk of chaos, I kind of like look around, I look behind me, I see a fox staring at me, wondering what I'm doing, and I go, yeah, the risk of chaos, but maybe this one time I can minimize the risk. Let's make a little adjustment. We don't need blue. Yeah, the blue wavelength is such a difficult thing to find, and it serves no practical purpose. Let's just block that wavelength. For now. Forever? Forever. Have a treat, Hugh. So I, like, just brush above my head, and I'm using those microscopic eyes that can see the wavelengths of color. And just in front of Indigo, way in front of Violet, the two wavelengths that never seem to reach, nature just puts a little bit of an invisible barrier in front of the third shortest wavelength and just nods and says, yeah. Yeah, that will make sense. All Blue needs to worry about is being in the sky. That's it.
The pulse of a lifetime of gathered starlight ripples out from you, wrapping around the entire world. The erasure is sudden, without flair or theatrics, as Blue is gone, regulated to the sky above and the water below. The ripple moves over a strange and beautiful form as they begin to wake not far from you.
A small pair of eyes would kind of just blink open in the darkness and kind of squinting against a single beam of sunlight. Agresta, a sort of fuzzy, weasel-like creature, slowly uncurls. These two antler-type protrusions coming out of her head just above those eyes stick upwards into the air as her nose just kind of lifts. She sniffs around, as is her morning routine. She rises to 4 feet, all covered in these sort of what look to be feathers from afar, but upon closer inspection, they're more like layered ferns. Every single one has these delicate protrusions, these very gentle sort of swaying motions as she stands, and a breeze that doesn't actually come from anywhere kind of ruffles through them. Her tail kind of like lashes behind her and stretches out and then settles as she rises and looks around at a tangle of roots around her. It's relatively dark here. There's the deep smell of earth and stone and a little bit of an irony sort of scent from nearby mineral veins that aren't quite uncovered but have such potential. And she kind of peers and almost glares a little bit at the single beam of sunlight that poked through a hole between the roots and in the soil and shone down right in her eyes as the late morning begins. My work is a lot more whimsical, far from anything related to a list, more to do with just passing moments of chasing whatever catches my attention and whatever feels it needs attention. Any plants around me that start to kind of reach up towards my paws as I step around the nearby area and begin to dig my way out from the tree roots and up into the open air are clamoring for attention, and I do my best to give it to them in passing. I poke my nose in a patch of moss, I kind of brush up against some grass and watch it grow a little bit taller and stand up a little bit straighter in my passing. In general, I just follow wherever my attention goes. And in particular, right now, it's staring up along the base of the tree that I just dug myself out from and kind of following the contours of the bark. My neck kind of cranes up towards the branches and follows them as they touch the walls and ceiling and the kind of ruined bricks and inorganic substance around me. And I just kind of give a little huff. All the plants near me flutter as it passes and seem to grow a little bit, seem to get a little bit more potent. I step over and kind of follow the contours of these ruins and especially examine the spots where plants might have started to poke through. In, you know, the cracks between the bricks and in the little jutting out points between the rubble. And I watch and observe all of them in various stages of life. Some have started to kind of crumble and decay and turn brown as the seasons pass and as the sun stops being able to reach them through the ceiling. And I see how others have started to take root. I can kind of go up to them and just with a gentle touch of a paw, coax out this bit of almost decay, but it doesn't quite smell like rot, and it doesn't smell like finality. Instead, it smells like a fresh start, like the freshly broken skin of an apple. And a bouquet, but of a different kind than usual. And I just kind of dip my nose into this patch of dying plant, and then almost silently, almost telepathically encourage the growth from its corpse before moving on and skipping over to the next sort of area.
Agresta, over your lifetimes of experience, have you noticed a difference in plant life between worlds that have sentient life and worlds that do not?
It's almost as if the worlds with sentient life have a talent for discovering potential that the plants themselves couldn't have on their own. Sure, there's a lot of death in the process, and very often that death isn't made up for. It's not fed back into the ultimate cycle, but at the same time, it spurs innovation. Agresta kind of wanders over to a piece of furniture in the corner of the room. It's a large table made of some sort of dark wood, and it's very polished. It's carved on the sides with these ornate sort of like decorations, this swirling filigree. And it doesn't smell like anything. And to a layman, it might seem like it's a waste of life, that it's been cut down and it has no new potential. And that might be true. But I kind of go over to one of the handles made of iron and just shove a paw underneath it and gently pry open one of the drawers. And inside, there's sheaves of paper. They've all been written on with various colors of ink. The colors themselves derived from other plants, from berries, from fruits. And the information that they hold, even though I myself can't read it, it's valuable to someone. And it has potential, it has a capacity for people to learn from it. And I just gently kind of nose through the papers and kind of inhale the smell of knowledge. And I take it in, and I replace it with kind of the same sort of scent and feeling that you get from ozone and from fresh snow, where everything is kind of muted, but there's more to discover underneath the surface. I just shove the drawer shut, hop on top of the table, and look around the room. And something is definitely missing. I start to investigate. With a bit of a hop, I leap from the desk, and a breeze, again with no apparent source, I use it and hop on it and ride it up towards the branches of the tree that I crawled out from underneath. And floating from one branch to the next, I work my way up, examining the world and the ruins below me as I do, noting the patches of moss, noting the grass, and especially feeling the contours of the bark beneath my feet. And everywhere I go, every breeze that I touch smells a little bit more floral, a little bit more whimsical. And I finally make one last leap and hop through a hole in the roof up onto some shingles. I plant my feet, and the moss that grows between them rises to meet my feet and cushions my fall just slightly and is noticeably more green. And I look around, and following the growth of the plants, the different brown patches, the different green patches, a single unusually green patch that should definitely be brown that has been somewhat altered, I hop down off the roof. I lift my nose from the pavement a little bit and stare back over my shoulder at the skyscrapers, at all of the metal and the concrete that rise its way through the sky. And the sky, which noticeably is the only thing still blue. I take a look and craning my neck up and kind of like twisting my tail against the pavement, brushing some of the dirt aside as I do. I want to make sure that whatever species comes next incorporates more of plant life into their everyday existence. There's so much inorganic stuff here. There's so much cement. There's so much metal. And it has occasional moments where the set makes sense, where you have petrichor after a rainy day, or you have, you know, shards of iron that mimic the sort of carnal nature of blood. And it makes sense in its own way. But there's more that can be done. And I feel like I want to make sure that whatever technology comes next, whatever progression happens, it's rooted in our roots and in the roots of the trees around the area. Agresta kind of pauses for a moment and follows the road up towards what would normally be a crossroads, and a particularly aggressive set of that, you know, one of those clover type ramps leading onto a highway where everything is just a spaghetti of inorganics. And I'm going to make my way following its contours down towards the ground. And as I reach a point of intersection where all of this pavement layered on top of itself makes it so you can no longer see the sun, I'm going to very quickly shove just a snout into a patch of dirt between the concrete. And I am going to kind of then just nose around a little bit and make enough of a bit of room where I can shove a paw in, and then shove aside some rubble and expose even more dirt. And as I do, my back, which has this row of closed flower buds across it, which look like honeysuckles, slowly begin to glow and open, just slightly, just enough. But at the same time, the air around me begins to pick up. It starts to grow in velocity. A small breeze picks up and then turns into a large breeze and turns into almost this dervish that smells sweet and, in a sense, hopeful. It smells like your first day of school. It smells like a fresh layer of fallen leaves. And a single one of these back spines, these honeysuckles, falls. I kind of plant my feet against the ground and do a little bit of a shake, just casually, something I've done a billion times before, and especially upon waking up in the roots of a tree. But this time, a single blossom detaches itself and just floats in the dervish and very gently plants into the middle of this dirt patch I've created. And as it does, in a very sudden explosion of energy and scent and all of these different emotions happening at once, it grows into a vast tree. It starts to move through every single moment of a tree's life cycle and shoot upward, poking through, exploding through the pavement in all of the layers above it and stretching out almost impossibly wide for its trunk size, breaking out into branches, each one of which has a different fruit on it. Different colors, except for blue, for some reason. Agresta kind of like narrows her eyes a little bit, staring up at the branches, wondering where that particular color went. But there's still apple-like fruits in various shades on the same sort of stretch of skin. There's oranges dimpled with slightly darker shades of color. There's a lot here. And she gently kind of like sniffs around the base of the trunk a little bit, kind of scratches around its roots just to make sure everything looks good. She follows the contours of the bark once again, and as if satisfied, she backs up, neck craned towards the sky and towards the branches, and just plants herself down a little bit in satisfaction. Just kind of sits in the shade, closes her eyes, and takes a deep sniff in. Okay, 12. I think the choice one works, where it says what you begin will become what you intend. What is the seed and what is the end? This tree right here represents roots that dig in and feed off of the decomposing corpses of other plants before it, and then a trunk that then splits into several different choices of what could potentially become of it. I hope that whatever species comes and passes by this tree can bask in its shade, but also notice the fruits and maybe make something out of it. Maybe they make new pigments, hue allowing, out of the different types of skin that cover these fruits. Maybe they use the different bits of wood and discover its properties and use it for something new. Maybe they build buildings out of it. Maybe they take the seeds and crossbreed them and create entirely new plants out of it, which have entirely new purposes. This right here is choice incarnate. And every single branch smells different, and it smells like a potential future.
Sanguis populi, the blood of the people, the dark protectors of the hidden city of Azeroth, deep within the illusory forest, familiar with death as they have eluded it, they are called upon for a desperate task, slaying a creature from the great beyond. Blythe.
This might not be easy, being surrounded by death. I don't understand how they can do it.
Elvira.
Someone must watch the bodies, and none do so as diligently.
Swan.
Into action so fast. I love when we get to go out.
It came from the sky. This great, pale monstrosity.
You just had to sate your hunger. You could have saved it for the beasts.
I prefer the gratuity.
Vampirism is not immortality. It only prolongs the inevitable. Is this the end for Sanguis Populi? Blood in the snow. A tale yet told. Halloween 2025.
Sorceress, lower the barrier for just a moment. Sanguis Populi departs.
Listen to Tales Yet Told wherever you get your podcasts.
Agresta, Hugh, you see one another across this glade. You see the work of one another. You see that the garden is good.
Oh, Agresta?
You can see Agresta just kind of like stop staring at you from across the glade. And then her head kind of lowers. It's very much like when a cat sees someone that they're not sure about, and she plants her feet and her tail kind of rises and she leans her neck forward and just kind of sniffs the air.
Okay, it's probably been a while. Agresta, it's Hugh. We did the Orbits project together.
You can see her honeysuckles on her back, which have kind of like perked up a little bit, start to lay flat again. Her tail lowers, and she just slowly, as if not even acknowledging your presence, very similar to the foxes that you passed in your journey, trots over and heads towards the middle of the glade and just kind of lifts her chin a little bit in your direction.
Right. Okay. Here, let me do this. And I put the light pencil kind of like behind your ear, like you're an animator sitting at a desk. The words that Hugh says are able to make a little bit more sense to you now. I'm not going to say I give you the ability to speak, I'm a colors guy, but this is going to help order make sense in your head, and it's going to, you know, make certain words look and feel like certain colors that Agresta would associate with their intended meaning.
Agresta kind of like paws at the ground a little bit around your feet and then lifts her head again, and a slight breeze passes, almost as a barrier between you two, but against any law of nature that you're familiar with, it curls its way back around and reaches your ears, kind of brushing past you. And as it does, you hear a couple words. Been busy, Hugh, haven't you?
Yes, I've been here. It's been a greens day. So I've been in the woods primarily. I still have another few places to get to. There's marshlands, meadows, the jungles.
Yeah. I mean, I admire your work. I saw the patch that you did back there towards that one house. But, I have to ask, what's the deal with all this? And I kind of tap the ground, just kind of reaching forward, almost as if to swipe at something, but instead I kind of twirl a single paw in a small circle, and rising through the dirt is what looks like a single bluebell that rises, curls over, unfurls, and instead is just a pallid shade of gray. And I just kind of look at it, and then look at you, and then look at it again.
Right, that flower. That's right. Okay, I must have been buried into the sand. I, like, wave a hand over it, and it turns like a kind of, like, marigoldy, sunflowery color. I made an executive decision. So, plant life, which I know is your domain with the scents, primarily absorb red, orange, yellow light, and blue's a rare color in nature. So, in a sense, I'm kind of correcting those man-made evolutionary things that make blues possible, and I'm returning them back to their original states, and to kind of ensure that whatever comes after isn't going to muck around with the natural order, I've put kind of a block on the blue wavelength from the sky. The sky will still be the same color. I can't stop that light from reflecting off of the water. But the plants, the animals, I like hold up a frog that would have been like a blue spotted frog. Like they don't need that color, you know? So I'm just fixing things, you know? And I don't normally get the opportunity to do that, but today I wanted something that couldn't be ruined.
You consider it ruining?
If it's blue, yeah. Blue doesn't occur naturally. It's not a natural color. It just shouldn't be in nature. They can make it. They can invent the color. They can study the sky, whatever they want to do artificially. But I didn't want it occurring in nature this time.
Do you intend to replace it with a new color, a new nature? This is a blank canvas, and it's our job to shape it.
I can't just replace. I mean, I can pick different ones. Like your blue bell there will now just be a bell.
I just stare down at it a little bit sadly, and then make eye contact again.
But no, I can't invent something else to take its place. I'd have to change the entire sun to do that. And if we, I mean, you've heard my rant about this before. We change the sun, you change how people live on the planet, you have to rebuild the eyes, you have to rebuild the mountains, and the mountains take forever to rebuild. And I've seen sentience change so much of my work because they could. And I just wanted one thing that they couldn't mess with this time. Something they couldn't break.
I feel as though it's not breaking. It's... One moment. And Agresta very promptly turns and just very quickly, with the wind at her heels, dashes her way back towards the building that she came from. She dances across the cobblestones, she moves past and beneath the shade of the tree that she grew, and she heads straight back towards the desk that she had opened earlier. And with a sort of, like, franticness, she noses open the same drawer that she had opened and shuffles through the papers. And after a moment, she pulls out one that she had seen in passing and just gently, with her mouth, grabs it and, doing her best not to drool over it, dashes her way back towards the clearing and then stomps right up towards Hugh's feet and spits it out and lays it out. She kind of, like, flattens it with her paws, and on it you can see what appears to be a drawing that might have been made by a child. There's a small house that mimics the shape and form of the one that she had just left, and out back there's a pond. There's a bunch of flowers that look like they could have been blue at one point, but instead they're replaced by a sort of melancholy yellow. And she just looks down at it and sits back and then looks up at you, and she goes, "That house is where I came from. It didn't exist before, but several things had to die in order to make it happen, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Do you understand that in order for light to shine through something, the light that you bend and are so familiar with, cracks have to form in its surface?"
And the clouds crack like a surface to allow a single beam of light to rest on the two of you. As you walk beside waterfall and meadow, rock and river, and as you speak to one another.
Assume I believe in emotion and feeling in that reaction, right? If I remove blue, what goes away, really? Blue is the color of sadness. Blue is the color of masculinity. Blue is authority. Blue is the depthness of sorrow. Blue is drowning. Blue is danger. If I take that, right, then maybe, just maybe, there isn't as much of a need for the destruction the sentience will inevitably do. I know red is still out there, I understand. I see this one color that doesn't need to exist in nature. Really, what do you lose, Agresta? What did I really take?
Agresta is silent for a while, and her eyes shift and tear themselves away from the paper in front of her and back up to you, into that void of a clipboard that you hold in your hand. And she kind of just bends her neck a little bit and tilts her head from side to side as if thinking really intensely. You can faintly smell the flowers across her back begin to give off this ancient sort of scent, like an old library book being opened for the first time in forever, as she goes through her memories. And eventually, she kind of gently folds the paper in half. And she goes, as another breeze kind of ruffles through your cells, "I suppose you're right. I will state for the record that the melancholy and the sadness helps us remember. And we might not always remember good things associated with blue, but there are good things out there. If you don't want it to represent sadness, what will be in its place?"
Hugh doesn't get the opportunity to show what he can do very often. And there is a twinge of him that is mulling over that question, what do you replace it with? So Hugh is going to attempt to feel. Okay, I have a 0 in feel, and I rolled a 7. If there is an invisible truth, you know it. How is what you create impacted by it? Agresta, I can't invent a color, but I can increase one. I can lengthen a wavelength, but we have to keep it to ourselves. I don't understand what the colors feel like so you have to tell me.
I'm going to make a love roll, if I can. It's the sort of impending sadness and the deep empathy for things that used to be blue, but also masked and kind of with the overtones of hope at what could be in its place. Huh. It was definitely a failure. It was a 6.
It is outside of your hands, Agresta, but it is not out of your intention. As whatever your heart is shaped like breaks with the knowledge that this world has lost a form of its true expression. So, Hugh, why don't you tell me what this new color is like? And Agresta, why don't you tell me where it shows up in the world?
I think we both know that it's out of our hands. We open the door to possibility and the door closes in front of us. And we stand there and the communication kind of breaking down, the mind colors fading, the breeze dying down. And I think there's the quiet understanding that while I did replace some things that would have been blue with other colors, the bluebells, the poisonous frog, that pigment might just need to disappear, become the absence of color. Not quite a black, not quite anything. A mirror, a reflective surface, a clearness. The true absence of color, merely a thing the other lights bounce off of. So when people wish to reminisce, when they wish to feel sad, and they try to conjure that color, that feeling, they are only faced with the reflection of the memory.
I feel as though Agresta starts to try and weave together, almost experimentally, some new flowers and almost like a lily for this frog that you've been holding the whole time. And she tries her best to conjure up what would normally be blue flowers. And their scent is gone. There is nothing except the absence of any feeling that could be associated with how they smell. And experimentally, she kind of crushes one underfoot, expecting that the exposure to air within the stems might cause something new, but instead there's nothing there. And she pauses for a moment. And almost silently, not in mourning, since mourning is no longer there, but more just in deep thought and deep reflection, she gently touches her tail, just the tip of it, to the crushed flower. And almost overwhelmingly, Hugh, you are bombarded with the scent of ozone and the scent of a candle that has just been snuffed out, this smoky sort of scent. It's not melancholy, but it's still the past. And it's still something that evokes feeling, but the feeling is difficult to place. And it's up to the interpreter to determine where it goes. As the frog kind of hops down onto the lily pad and just kind of regards Agresta as she works, the smell of smoke kind of fades a little bit and is replaced with a slight after scent of decay and new beginnings still, as she imagines, but with a little bit less knowledge to them and a little bit more contemplativeness. And she kind of just sits back and then cocks her head sideways at you.
Well, it would seem you and I, per the ancient laws, created nothing. An absence of a color. That's a first.
Well done.
I guess we'll see if it was or not.
She just kind of plops backward into a sitting position and lifts a paw up towards you as if to shake your hand.
I shake your paw and I take back the pencil of light, freeing you from the burden of more complex thought.
You see Agresta rise to her feet and kind of like nose at this pale frog and just gently lift it onto her snout and then reach over towards her shoulder and place it on her shoulder. And she just gives you a little nod and then turns around and walks back towards the house that she came from, leaving the piece of paper still folded on the grass beneath her feet.
When two stars gather, a work must be. We close the book, just for now. There is still such a long ways left to go. There is still so much heart work left to attend to. If someday we hope to once again resemble a place that one could call a home. Thank you for tuning in to The Heart is a Dungeon for this episode of The Ballad of Heartwork. Let's meet our incredible guests. Hugh, do you have a name or are you just throwing shade?
Hi, I'm Grant. I played Hugh and I apologize for all future baby showers. You can find me, I'm the titular Game Master over at Game Master Monday. We play a new one-shot in a new system with a new cast every episode. And we do a lot of live mini-series on Twitch. And there's probably one happening right now. I don't know which one it is. That's in the future and I'm here. But there's probably one right now.
Agresta, smell you later. Do you have a name?
Hi, I do indeed. I am Diana Faye. I played Agresta for this episode. I am at Diana the Rose on all platforms, where you can find me as a Twitch partner, where I'm a member of both the Pride Guild and the Latin Guild. I am also, oh my god, a short form creator, so I'm on TikTok, Reels, Shorts, things like that. And then also a long form creator, so you can find the occasional YouTube video where I go on for 14 minutes about the same topic, and miraculously, I don't lose audience members. I'm also a model in my spare time, so you can find me on Instagram for some bits and pieces from there, and then also one of two co-hosts of the Worlds Apart podcast. Worlds Apart is a podcast where my friend Odin and I hang out and just build a world completely from scratch, just riffing, and then once we finish up a certain segment, we invite some of our creator friends on to play a one-shot in the world that you watched us build. So that's a relatively new one, but there's so much more that I do. The Instagram bio grows by the day, so I think I'll just cut it off there.
And I'm Ra-Ra. But that's enough about that.